filling them and listening at the same time. And that's the beauty. That's the aesthetic criterion that.
I'm Annie.
And I'm Parker.
And you're listening to
WGXC Acre
Hudson
Catskill 90.7 FM.
Amazing!
If you like radio that painstakingly stitches together seemingly unlike music in delightfully unpredictable ways, then check out WGXC's Overlooked, the second and fourth Tuesday of each month, just after the new news. You'll hear underheard and overlooked music, ancient to future, from every corner of the Omniverse. That's Overlooked on 90.7 WGXC.
Do you like a little ukulele? Ukuleles Unleashed is broadcast live from the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill. Carmen Borgia hosts the live segment, and John Sturman spins the finest ukulele music from every nook and cranny of our crazy old Earth. So, if you're like me and you like a little ukulele, tune in to Ukuleles Unleashed on WGXC 90.7 FM the third Tuesday of every month from 8 to 10 p.m. or find us later in the archive at WGXC.org. Hear Ukuleles Unleashed Tuesday, March 19th from 8 to 10 p.m.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first-run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The Hudson Valley Picture Show traveling series brings cinema to locations around the region. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the Community Theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Peggy Awesh of Catskill, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Haiti, Honduras, and U.S. hegemony. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Haiti and Honduras have made headlines in the last few weeks. Honduras's former president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was just convicted in a U.S. court of drug trafficking. He faces life in prison. Haiti's a nation without a government, as armed groups have united against the U.S.-backed unelected prime minister installed after the assassination of their president in 2021. In both cases, what's missing from mainstream news coverage is the role of U.S. intervention that brought them to this point.
The crisis in Haiti is a crisis of imperialism.
University of British Columbia professor Jemima Pierre, a Haitian-American scholar, explained on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. In her NACLA Report article headlined Haiti as Empire's Laboratory, she describes her home country as, quote, the site of the longest and most brutal neocolonial experiment in the modern world, unquote. Haiti was the world's first black republic, founded in 1804 following a slave revolt. France demanded Haiti pay reparations for the loss of slave labor when Haiti's enslaved people freed themselves. For more than a century, Haiti's debt payments to France, then later to the U.S., hobbled its economy. The The United States refused to recognize Haiti for decades until 1862, fearful that the example of a slave uprising would inspire the same in the United States. In 1915, the U.S. invaded Haiti, occupying it until 1934. The U.S. also backed the brutal Duvalier dictatorships from 1957 to 1986. Jean-Bertrand Aristide became Haiti's first democratically elected president in 1991, only to be ousted in a violent coup 8 months later. The coup was supported by President George H.W. Bush and later by President Bill Clinton. Public pressure forced Clinton to allow Aristide's return in 1994 to finish his presidential term in 1996. Aristide was reelected in 2001.
In 2004, as has been revealed and admitted to, the U.S., France, and Canada got together and backed a coup d'etat against the country's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Jemima Pierre continued.
The U.S. Marines flew into his home, put him on a plane with his security officials, his wife, and aide, and flew them to the Central African Republic.
Democracy Now! Traveled to the Central African Republic in 2004, covering a delegation led by TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson and U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters, who defied U.S. policy and escorted the Aristides back to the Western Hemisphere. Aristide confirmed then to Democracy Now! That he'd been ousted in a coup d'etat backed by the United States. Aristide then went to live in exile in South Africa for the next 7 years. In response to allegations that gangs are currently controlling Haiti, Professor Pierre said,
"The so-called gang violence is actually not the main problem in Haiti. The main problem in Haiti is the constant interference of the international community. And the international community here is very explicitly the U.S., France, and Canada."
The Biden administration is reportedly now considering the transfer of Haitian asylum seekers to the controversial U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, a repeat of some of the worst U.S. policies in its long history of exploitation of Haitians. Honduras, meanwhile, currently has a democratically elected president, Xiomara Castro. Her husband, Manuel Mel Zelaya, was elected president in 2006, then ousted in a U.S.-backed coup in 2009. In the following years, Honduras descended into a narco state, forcing hundreds of thousands to flee violence, seeking asylum in the United States and elsewhere. In 2013, Juan Orlando Hernandez was elected president amidst allegations of campaign finance violations. Then again in 2017, in an election widely considered fraudulent. Shortly thereafter, his brother, Juan Antonio Hernandez, was arrested in Miami for drug trafficking. Then, following Xiomara Castro's election, former President Juan Orlando Hernandez himself was arrested and extradited to the U.S. for cocaine trafficking. On March 8th, he was convicted in U.S. federal court and is currently awaiting sentencing.
The evidence was chilling.
History professor Dana Frank, who was in the courtroom, said on Democracy Now!,
"This litany of assassinations of prosecutors, assassinations of journalists, corruption of the police, the military, politicians, the president, his brother, you name it. And it was like the curtain was drawn back and you could see the day-to-day workings of this tremendous, violent, corrupt mechanism that was the Juan Orlando Hernandez administration, but also that of Pepe Lobo, as you said, before him. And all of this was what happened after the 2009 coup that opened the door for the destruction of the rule of law in Honduras."
U.S. intervention in Haiti, Honduras, and other countries is one of the principal drivers of people seeking asylum in the United States as they flee violence, poverty, and persecution at home. This point is almost never mentioned in the U.S. press. To understand and ultimately solve the immigration crisis, Americans need to understand what their government has long done in their name with their tax dollars, arming and propping up brutal regimes abroad. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
That was radio artist Gregory Whitehead with the track India Alpha Mike from 2014. Coming up next from our friends at WOOCLP, our partner station up in Troy,
They did an interview with Nick Vanderkolk from the Love and Radio radio show about radio. But first, this next track is When Radios Sleep, What Dreams May Come, from renowned radio artist Anna Frith and Delaware County farmer and radio artist Tiana Kennedy.
Thank you. Nick Vanderkolk, the producer of the podcast Love and Radio, visited the Uptown Summer Youth Employees at the Sanctuary for Independent Media and discussed podcasting techniques as the youth prepare to create audio stories of their own.
It's worked out for me pretty well, but like I kind of did everything opposite, like how you should.
I kind of grew up listening to a lot of sort of public radio.
One thing that they teach you in that kind of genre is that radio is a didactic medium. It's not enough to sort of present a story. You have to sort of like explain what it means, and you have to sort of explain everything. And that's a totally legit way of going about things. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I love that operates that way, but I personally always found that quite limited. And so even though the show has like evolved a lot over the last 13 years, it's always had that DNA in it of like, I didn't want to tell people like what they were supposed to feel and what they were supposed to think. And so that's why there's very little of me in it, why you're just hearing this voice and people kind of have to piece it together kind of on their own, which I think can make for like a more powerful storytelling experience, for lack of a better term.
Do you think that radio has become less critical of itself? Radio or podcasts, they've become more narrative, more linear kind of storytelling. So do you think that it's, I mean, obviously it's changing.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm pretty mixed on it. I mean, I think in some ways, when I was starting out, there was like so little competition out there. And you would think with more shows, there's going to be like more diversity of approaches. But I think also, because there's money in there now, people want to do the thing that is definitely going to succeed. And they do end up sounding pretty similar. There are a lot of, especially in podcasting, there are a lot of shows that are just much easier to produce, mm-hmm. that are like kind of chat-based. And it's like people sitting in a room, and those require some work and thought to make still good, but it's much easier to get like advertisers for that. It's much easier to pitch that to like a network. I tend to record for hours and hours and hours and hours, and then that gets edited down. So I'd say each episode typically takes about a month of work. Typically, and this is just sort of how, this wasn't necessarily intentional, but you tend to hear a lot more questions as the story goes on, because it's also just like, there's a certain style in sort of radio documentary, for lack of a better term, where you completely cut out the interviewer, and it's just sort of this monologue, and I personally like to be reminded that there is someone else in the room that's asking questions, so that you have to have like a little bit of skepticism, I think. So I don't prep people other than to sort of describe the process and describe the show and say, you know, this is all pre-recorded, so like if you want to back up and go again, that's totally cool. And then we just kind of wing it. And then you just have to sort of respect their space and kind of let them sort of take the lead on sort of what they're comfortable with. I don't get to do face-to-face interviews all that much these days, but it's also it's like relatively easy too. Like now you can kind of interview people from wherever. And there's lots of great tools where they can kind of mic themselves as well. Like now we have advertisers, we have some resources, so we can usually get like an engineer to go and record the person in person. And so I'll interview them over the phone, or a producer of mine will interview them over the phone, and someone else will be in the room with them recording them. And then we combine the tape together, mm-hmm. so it basically sounds like they're in the same room. That's called a tape sync. In general, I do two-hour interviews. The first one tends to have very little structure to it, where I'm really just kind of like just following my own curiosity about the person and just having a discussion around it. The second interview, at that point, I have a better understanding of like what the shape of the story ought to be, so the second interview tends to be much more directed, just sort of like kind of the skeleton of the story. And then based on those two things, then we begin the process of editing, and in the process of editing, we tend to notice, well, there's this, like, actually, this is this question that, like, I actually hadn't really considered now that I'm, like, listening to him tell the story again. So let's go back and we'll ask him that. Or he didn't tell this thing. He told this one story in a slightly confusing way. Maybe we can have him retell that piece. So then we do a third follow-up interview. And that one tends to be a bit shorter because we know sort of like, okay, we want to get this, and this. And then hopefully, like, we have everything that we need from that.
So one thing I heard that is very cool, is that you, as a radio artist and a storyteller, are using some other audio tracks to emotionally carry the story on. Could you talk about that a little?
We use music. There's a lot of kind of subtle stuff going on. We actually, like, we run the voice through filters, so we're just sort of creating that space. We're just, like, very focused on the audio and also just sort of how the audio interacts. If it is a piece that has, like, kind of rich audio elements to begin with, I will be collecting the sounds in the moment. In terms of finding the subjects, it's, well, as the show has become more popular, we have relied more and more on kind of outside pitches, so, like, listeners will write in with ideas for stories, or radio freelancers who will pitch stuff to us. But before that, it really was kind of all over the shop. I mean, sometimes it was just, like, stories that, like, a friend would tell me, you know, oh, my neighbor, you know, down the block, like, he's a survivalist or whatever. I didn't actually do that story, I don't know. But someone was telling me about that the other day. Sometimes it's because we have this, like, slightly strange format, it's also very, very helpful for doing stuff that has been in the news to some degree. So, for instance, I did a story about a guy who was in his 20s and his wife died of cancer. And before she had died, she had written out sort of like her life goals, and he had committed his life to finishing out her life goals. So, and a lot of it was, like, quite ambitious. It was like, get a PhD, run a half marathon, take a train across Canada. And I had seen, he had been on a couple, like, TV shows, but just, like, these very quick little four-minute segments where it was like, oh, here's this guy doing this crazy thing. You know, tell us a couple of things about it. Okay, cool, bye. And I knew there was, like, more of a long-form story there. Things about it. Okay, cool, bye. And I knew there was, like, more of a long-form story there. And I think he was, like, quite grateful to actually, like, take the time. Most of the people that I talk to are really happy with how things turn out, because I really give them the space and the time to talk things through in a way that you don't get in media generally. I'm sure we've all seen at some point some sort of, like, very combative interview between, like, a host and a guest. Maybe the guest is doing something wrong or whatever, but, like, then they serve no purpose other than to show that the host is, like, somehow morally superior, and I'm not interested in that. You know, if there is someone who's sort of, like, morally dodgy who I have on the show, I don't have them on the show so I can harangue them. I still want to understand them, be out in the world and just, like, meeting random weirdos
and open to serendipity.
And open to serendipity, yeah. I mean, especially in this day and age, like, everything is, like, on the internet, and so it's very easy to have these, like, curated experiences in your lives, and sometimes it's nice to just, like, throw out the phone and just go for a walk and, like, see what the hell you happen upon. You know, the stories that I go after tend to be the ones where I don't know how I feel about them myself. You know, I don't go in with an agenda, and that often makes the best pieces, when it's like when your mind changes over the course of working on it. That's a sign that you're on something really good.
That was Nick Vanderkoek, producer of the podcast Love and Radio.
I'm Tom Rowe, and you're listening to the radio.
You take the ability to talk for granted, don't you? Then why shouldn't you? You talk every day of your life and you don't think much about it. But did you realize that millions of people suffer from voice problems? These millions can't take talking for granted. For them, to talk is a struggle.
Do you have a voice like... Do you have a voice like... Do you have a voice like... Mine? Do you have a voice like... As it is done. Do you have a voice like... Is it done? Do you have a voice like... Mine? Do you have a voice like... Do you want a voice like mine? Do you want a voice like... Mine? Do you want a voice like... Is he? Do you want... Do you want a voice like... With a voice like mine? What would you want a voice like? Do you want a voice? Do you want a voice like... What would you do with a voice like... What would you do? How would you survive? Would you seize me? Would you hide? Would you seize power? Would you dissect it? Ingest it? Roll it around on your tongue? And then what? And then what? And then what? Would it give you pleasure? Would it get you in? Would it take you away? Gently? With a light touch? Take it out. Take it away. Take it. How can you... Take it out. Take it away. Take it. Gently? With a light... Roll it around on your pleasure. And then what? 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 And then what?
She sang the best she'd ever sang. She could never sing any better. But Mr. Davidson never rang. She knew he would forget her. She'd seen him there and put herself to ransom. He had stared. He really was quite handsome. She had really looked her best. She couldn't but she knew she'd failed the test. She knew he would forget her. Triumphant was the way she felt as she acknowledged the applause. Triumphant was the way she felt when she saw him. Happier than she'd ever been as he praised her for her grace. But his expression changed, she had seen, as he leant to kiss her face. It ended there. He claimed a late appointment. She quickly turned to hide her disappointment. She ripped her glittering gown, couldn't face another show, no. Her deodorant had let her down, she should have used eau de rose.
It's smooth sailing with the highly successful sound of wonderful Radio London.
Radio London.
Espers with Cruel Storm. Before that, from The Who's Sell Out, and Gregory Whitehead.
Mike?
That was radio artist Gregory Whitehead with the track India Alpha Mike from 2014.
Audio radio. 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 Audio radio.
Dead letters.
Most celebrities tend in the course of many years to develop an illegible handwriting. I see that with nearly everybody. Marilyn Monroe, for instance, began by printing her letters very neatly and wound up by developing a script that is extraordinarily difficult to read. And the same is true of Judy Garland, who started out with a beautiful, legible handwriting and wound up with the most vicious scrawl that I think I've ever seen. It just is almost impossible to make out anything.
What has come from this dreary piece of stone?
The definition of a heart, a piece of that is considered hard. The definition is one, no name on it or no address, part of the address missing, the state missing, the city missing. That's a heart.
All right, it's a jigsaw puzzle that you try to put together and come to a conclusion, just see where that letter's going to.
For instance, a foreign mail coming in saying 225 Broadway, New York. Now, what city is that? It comes here, New York City, because we have a Broadway that's well known. But you could be in Albany, or could be in Kingston, could be in, what, Jamaica, or anywhere where there's a Broadway. And now, the foreign person, at this particular point, there's nothing we can do with that. We can try it here in this city, and that's the only thing we can do. At that point, if we can't find it, we'll kill it and send it back, and we'll give them a reason. The reason why is no city mentioned. So let them, the sender, send it over with the proper city.
Let's put it this way. From Greece, you get a letter with a name that very difficult to decipher. But you keep saying it over maybe two or three times, and you get the drift of it.
You get into the habit of talking to yourself because you have to verbalize. Sometimes, especially with foreign letters, you've got to verbalize different things in order to catch it in your mind. That's important with foreign letters. Sometimes it's important with kid letters. Kids who write them have to say, okay, I can see it's a kid writing. Now, what's he thinking about? How does he talk? So you start talking, if you want to, you can do this. And that's what I love doing this, by the way, because if you get into the drift of it, you can actually, it forms in your mind, it forms on the paper, that kind of thing going on.
I like the jigsaw puzzle analogy in that, it's a puzzle that there are, of which pieces are missing, and there are also four or five pieces that we don't know where they fit.
And that's the problem with a lot of reconstructions. They're often done for the media. Here's a blurb for a new dinosaur book. Dinosaur books come out all the time. They become more and more outrageous looking. Here's a herd of them, babies that have different shapes than the adults, and these, as it so happens, are of animals that we don't have any juvenile dinosaur skeletons of. They have all kinds of surface texture and expressions and implied behavior. These things are roaring around in some kind of a stampede. I think there's enough weird things that are real without having to more or less create some new ones. Dinosaurs in many ways parallel the human type of evolutionary studies in the sense that a lot of people that do it are drawn in more by the theater aspect rather than the scientific aspects of it. I mean, it seems to me common sense that you can't tell the color of an extinct organism or you can't tell what sound it makes. We don't have any larynx. I mean, you don't have any of these soft parts preserved in these animals. All that's cartilage or connective tissue, and it's something not present. You have the backbone, you have the palate and other things, but you don't have any of the devices that are actually concerned in making noise. Reptiles or modern squamata go in for peculiar kinds of tongues. What kind of tongues the dinosaurs have, well, nobody knows. You can hypothesize almost anything to get any kind of sound. So that is real science fiction.
Somebody was just in to see me, I think even while you were here, and he showed me some documents, one of which was signed by Hitler on his last birthday. He was to shoot himself and bite into a cyanide capsule at the same time 10 days later. And the signature is so badly written, it's nothing but a smear. It looks like a crushed insect. Hitler was so far gone, he could barely write. He could not feed himself, as a matter of fact. He threw food all over himself when he tried to eat.
Every man harbors within himself an idea that he would like to become immortal. My particular way of doing it is I take a poem which is immortal, and which has fascinated men and women for 27 centuries or more, and which will continue to fascinate them as long as the human race exists. I take this poem, and by memorizing it, I absorb it into myself and make it an integral part of myself. That's my means of achieving immortality, attaching myself to a vehicle which is in itself immortal.
Everything I had is gone.
Of course, I did experience what people always say about amputations, the lingering sensation of the end of the finger, and I mean sometimes really irritating, an itch, you know, this sensation of wanting to itch my fingers and not being able to and having to rub it somewhere else and not being satisfying. I mean, this ghost of fingers hovering.
I suppose Josephine applied the test, but I declined to handle Napoleon's penis because I felt that it was in bad taste. In any event, it was just nothing but a withered tendon, and it was sold first. It was put up for sale by Christie's, and they were unable to get the amount of the reserve on it, which was, together with a few other relics that accompanied it, $40,000. So it was then sold in Paris. I sort of thought, wouldn't it be a romantic idea if the French were to buy this missing part of Napoleon's anatomy and bury it with him in Les Invalides, where his body lies, as you know, in that great black sarcophagus, that marble sarcophagus. But they did not do that. It went to an American urologist who treasures this little piece of anatomy.
What is it? You can see its chunky bulk. It's jolly hard. And if 1,000 people were to touch it, all that would happen would be that it would be have a patina of people's pores. What has it done? It has helped to reveal and to make understood a whole ancient culture in a way that was completely hidden. The British Museum had been in existence 50 years, approximately, and it started off as a kind of immense rag bag. The core